Well, happy Thursday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to WFSU-FM and our regular excursion into the unknown. We call it Perspectives, and you're always welcome to be part of the discussion at 414-1234. 800-926-8809 is the long-distance connection to us. We also have an email, perspectives@wfsu.org, or tweet us at WFSU Perspective. I'm Tom Flanagan. And as we said at the outset of the program, the saga of the crazy uncle, and I don't mean to be disparaging when it comes to uncles. I got a lot of them, and I love them all to death. But the one who flies into a rage every time the topic of politics comes up, it just seems too common to write off as an isolated aberration. Everybody has a story like this of a relative or a friend who has sort of sunken into the political swamp, and they just never come back up. And as the decibel level and the partisanship of our political discourse has risen so dramatically during this present political cycle, these kinds of stories are becoming more and more frequent. So it all kind of boils down to the question, does a constant exposure to political news, particularly the high volume and high intensity kind from cable TV news channels and talk radio, cause actual changes in such things as brain chemistry, attitudes, and behavior? And so how better to kick off a discussion of that than to bring in some eminent experts in that field from right here at Florida State University to chat a little bit about it. So let's go around the table and meet him first. We say hi first to Dr. Brad Schmidt, Distinguished Research Professor and Director of Anxiety and Behavioral Health Clinic at FSU. Dr. Brad, good to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me. Really happy to be here.
All righty. And right next door to you is Dr. Dina Rollinger with the FSU Department of Sociology, who is going to be talking about some of the political ramifications there, because that's kind of your bailiwick, right?
Oh, love talking media and politics, Tom.
Well, so happy to have both you guys in here. Let me tell you what precipitated this whole thing. This eminent journalistic publication by the name of Rolling Stone. Okay, I'm an old rock and roller. You guys know that. I've been playing drums for years and years, and now desperately trying to become a halfway competent guitarist. And before I die, maybe I will be able to know more than 10 chords, which would be really an accomplishment. In the October 20th issue of Rolling Stone, there was a great article that came out called The Age of Fear. And it's by Neil Strauss, who has done a number of things in that magazine and other publications. And in it, the premise is that if you live in a state of high anxiety, this can cause changes in everything from brain chemistry to your attitudes, to your behaviors, your interactions with other people, and all of that. And here's the premise from which we will start, and this is in the article. This is a quote from Andrew Huberman, a Stanford neurobiology professor who runs a lab that studies the topic of fear. And he says, the more we learn about the brain, the more we learn it's not something that's supposed to make you happy all the time. It's mostly a stress-reactive machine. And its primary job is to keep us alive, which is why it's so easy to flip people into fear all the time. Dr. Brad, does that sound like a true statement to you?
That's exactly right, actually, Tom. The notion that the brain is a stress-reactive machine really gets at the most central thing to consider when you think about anxiety, and that is anxiety. The reason we have it, humans and all animals have it, is that it's an adaptive, useful, good thing. And the reason why it's so useful is that from an evolutionary perspective, it has been designed to protect us from threats. And so the brain is really designed, a big part of it is designed to keep us safe, to protect us from threats, to allow us to effectively detect those threats, and to deal with them. And this is oftentimes referred to as sort of a fight-flight reaction, which is sort of another association I had to your discussion about your uncle. When we think about anxiety, we think about the flight side of things, because anxiety is designed to keep us away from threats, so we want to run away if there's a perception of threat. But sometimes we can't do that. We can't avoid it. So what do we do then? Then the fight side kicks in. That's why you might see this increase in anger, rage, and aggressive behavior in circumstances where maybe you can't get away.
So in today's political environment and with the media, Dean, if we can talk about your level of involvement in this, if you do not flee from the coverage, then you have to stay and fight, right?
Right. That's a really good way of thinking about it. And I think people underestimate how much time they spend with media, so how much time they're actually on their phones. So one of the things I was actually reading about this morning is this real move for technological ethics. And simply what that means is we don't consider how our phones, these apps, social media are designed to make us anxious and engage them. So if you periodically tell someone you like them or you friend request them, what that does, it makes you attend to that app more often. So if you think about this in terms of politics, if you're constantly engaging and you have this level of anxiety, you're your own worst enemy in this regard, right? You have to recognize that that the media, that the technology that we're using is designed to pull us in, and we have to try to find ways to pull ourselves out.
And is that even possible? Dr. Brad, can you do that in today's environment and say, okay, I'm putting down the phone, I'm shutting off the tube, I am going to, for the next 12 hours, let's say, totally isolate myself from the rest of humankind and just sit back and whether it's contemplating my navel or just reading a good book or something, can you disconnect that easily today?
Well, you can. Some people can anyway. In fact, personally, I don't like to watch the news or listen to things, but it's very difficult. And I think that's the point you're raising, Tom, that the way, you know, I guess in the old days they used to say sex sells, right? But fear sells too. And if you think about the media, people have learned that if you get folks riled up, anxious, afraid, they're going to tune in. And a lot of the shows that you see on TV are geared and designed in that way. And it is difficult for folks to break free from that.
Yeah, and Dina, that's like if you're looking at commercial media, I hate to reveal this because I was in that bailiwick for a while. The idea is not so much to engage people necessarily in a high-minded discussion of public policy. The idea is to get them to watch over the next commercial cluster so that they can catch the latest outrage from Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton on the other side of the break, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the great tension with commercial media. So on the one hand, there's so many stations people can tune into, and they have to find ways. Anchors have to find ways. The commentators have to find ways to make sure that we are paying attention. And those breaks are long, Tom. You might have noticed some of these breaks are long. And so making sure that we'll stay in our seats or at least have the TV on while we're waiting for them to come back on. I mean, this is one half of the formula. But the part that has gotten lost, and we've heard about it a bit in this election, is the democratic function of commercial media and their obligation to discuss issues in a way that is helpful to the citizenry, which works directly against fear, right?
Yeah, and that's what you said too, Brad. If you are using this as a tool to keep people on the literally on the edge of their seat and very anxious and very concerned and even fearful to a degree, that's almost, can that be addictive in a degree?
I don't know that you would call it addictive, but I think you're playing into this propensity that we all have, the brain has, which is the brain is designed to be vigilant and detect threat. And so the availability of all these media outlets, that's where our brains are naturally going to orient us. Because here we see, oh, there's this threat I need to, not consciously, but here's this threat I need to deal with, I need to attend to. Part of the function of anxiety is a problem-solving function. That's what worry is all about. That's why we worry. we're trying to figure out these things, right? And so the brain is telling us, hey, there's this threat. We need to figure this out. Let's attend to it. Let's think about it over and over again. We'll finally come up with a solution, hopefully. So it's definitely playing into the way our brain is designed. I don't know if I'd call it an addiction, because addictions involve sort of pleasure. And as we were sort of talking about earlier, there's nothing really pleasurable about anxiety. In fact, it was designed to be aversive, so we would pay attention to it, right? So that's part of why people are attending, because anxiety feels bad and you want to do something to get rid of it.
But conversely, though, is it not possible, though, by keeping people in this state of a mental arousal, if you will, that then that becomes normative? This is the way I live. I am always on edge because I was just told there's a threat at the door. You know, it's the Islamic terrorist. And over here, there's a threat. Why? It's the Wall Street banker who's going to disrupt my family's finances. The threats are everywhere. I need to be on top of them all the time.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point you're raising, and it also sort of speaks to a quote that you had from the Rolling Stone article about the age of fear. There's been some research suggesting that the average level of fear or anxiety in the United States has increased over time. If you look at trait levels of anxiety, so the average levels of anxiety that people are experiencing, so 20, 30 years ago, we're significantly more anxious than we were. Why that is, people don't have, you know, all the answers to it, but some of what we're discussing today most likely has something to do with it. The other interesting thing about it is, if you look at immigrants, people that come to the United States, and you look at those that have been here, you find that even the folks coming in, their anxiety gets jacked up over time compared to, you know, when they first arrived, when the family first arrived, or compared to the home country. So there's something about being here in the United States that has this very negative effect on anxiety.
Oh, my gosh. It's a new form of American exceptionalism. Hey, we are talking about the impact of not only politics, but also other anxiety-causing stimuli on our behaviors, our mental well-being, and maybe the way that we look at life, right here on Perspectives with Dr. Brad Schmidt and Dr. Dina Rollinger, both from Florida State University. And we'll take your calls and emails, too, when we come back right here on Perspectives. Hey, welcome back to Perspectives on this. It's just under a week before the election, after which, of course, tranquility will prevail. There will be a mass accommodation. People will forget their differences. We'll come together. It'll be great. Dina, I don't think that's going to happen, is it?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. So the good news is that our response, our emotional response, is relatively short-lived. So when we're emotionally invested in an election, we're really invested in the outcome, obviously. But losers are affected more than winners. But they've shown that that tends to fade after about a week. So a week from Tuesday, perhaps people will be feeling a bit better.
Okay. And maybe perhaps the adrenaline levels will be down a bit. That has something to do with the fight and flight response, Brad, you were talking about, right? And you can't keep those jacked up all the time. There's a self-limiting thing in there that eventually you burn through your store of adrenaline and it has to be replaced, right?
Yeah, so part of our sort of nervous system, you know, capability is this kind of sympathetic side. And then it's sort of opposed by a parasympathetic side, which do work to offset each other. And so when folks feel anxious or aroused, they do get that adrenalized response. You know, the heart rate goes up, your respiration goes up. And again, if we think about the adaptive nature of fear, these are all preparing the individual to more effectively run away or, if need be, to fight. So there's all this arousal that's occurring. But you're right, it can't go on forever. And eventually the other side of the nervous system kicks in to sort of calm things down. And so sometimes people experience like a rebound effect. They get very aroused and then they almost feel kind of washed out and exhausted after a very high anxiety or arousal episode. And that's part of the way the nervous system works over time.
But what happens if you have not a big spike or a series of spikes, but if you have an elevated anxiety level? I'm thinking here specifically of maybe in a combat situation where you are not actually out there in the front lines fighting all the time, but at any moment, a threat could impinge upon your world, and you got to be cognizant of that. So you're always kind of on alert.
Sure. Yeah, and there are plenty of instances where in a combat situation, even folks that experience chronic anxiety disorders will have chronically elevated levels of anxiety over time. So you can certainly have chronic anxiety, heightened anxiety, those sort of more acute peaks when sort of the systems are turning on and turning off, so you see some fluctuation. But even in the context of that, folks can have very high levels of anxiety over time.
Is this healthy?
Well, I guess the answer to that is probably not. And the reason I sort of qualify that is, again, anxiety is an adaptive bodily function, if you want to think about it in that way. So it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for heightened anxiety to be, you know, really terrible on the body. Long term, however, most likely it's not a good thing, right? So our bodies are designed to withstand arousal and to withstand what happens when we have this anxious arousal. But there are data to suggest that if you have severe anxiety conditions for decades, that probably has adverse medical consequences for some. So yeah, long term, not good. Short term, it's definitely okay.
Okay. But it is used in both long and short term, Dr. Dina, when it comes to things like political discourse. Now, throughout humankind history, there have been tendencies to always demonize the opposition. If you elect this other person, or if this other individual becomes king or prime minister or whatever, horrible things will befall us. The country will go to hell and children will die and all this sort. And yet, if you look at the history of the United States over time, no matter who's in office, yeah, there's good times and bad times, but by and large, it all kind of washes out. But today, it just seems a little bit more hyperventilative, perhaps, than it has been in the past, where it's not this other person has some ideas that may not be as good as my ideas. It's the other person is going to kill you, essentially, and your family is going to be at risk, and it'll be the end of the world as we know it, to quote REM there.
Right. And yeah, this is absolutely true. America has gotten more politically polarized over the last 25 years. And what the research is showing is part of that is we're just really entrenched in our political identities in ways that we weren't before. In fact, when they did recent research, they found that we care more about our political identity than we do our religious identity. So you would think that that would lead to more political engagement, but that does not necessarily seem to be true. What it does mean is we view our opponent in way more hostile ways than we did previously. So 25 years ago, people could see themselves marrying across party lines in the 72% area. But now that seems impossible. So not only can we not talk to those people on the other side of the aisle, we can't have conversations with them, we can't be friends with them, and the idea of marrying someone that doesn't agree with you politically is just not something that would be in your universe today. And that's problematic for democratic institutions, right? It's problematic for consensus building and working together. But I can say for folks that are just really concerned about what will happen on Tuesday, we have to remember how our political system is set up, and most changes happen incrementally rather than overnight. So it's unlikely that, regardless of who wins, the world is going to crumble on Wednesday.
The Republic may still survive.
We might.
Folks, would love to hear from you when it comes to any kind of stories that you have regarding a family member or a longtime friend who may have sort of fallen into this morass of super partisan media and all of that that we're seeing right now at 414-1234. Let us know. No names are required, but we'd really like to hear some experiences that you may be having in this regard, too, of folks who seem to have changed dramatically as the political season has worn on. Or you can also send us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. I'll start it off here. I was telling both Brad and Dina about this a little bit ago. A longtime friend of mine, in fact, a former musician buddy, and if anyone is listening out there who has been a part of a band over the years, that in a way is like a, and it's usually guys, so I'll call it a male marriage, where you have this very intimate relationship between people because they're picking each other's brains and deepest part of their souls when it comes to playing music together. It's a very unique kind of dynamic that's going on. And this guy I have known for years and years has always been a sort of an apolitical Democrat. He has consistently voted Democratic. In the past year and a half, however, he has gone totally nutso. He has unfriended just about everyone on Facebook who does not agree with his political proclivities, which, by the way, happened to be not for Donald Trump, but for Bernie Sanders. He believes that Senator Sanders had the primary election stolen from him by the Hillaryites. He cannot bring himself to forgive anyone associated with the Hillary Clinton campaign, and immediately he's alienated just about everybody. And he's not the guy I grew up playing music with. He is totally different. He's argumentative. He's nasty. You cannot reason with the guy. And I still love him to death, but I can't talk to him anymore. So if you have a similar story in your life that you would like to share, please, 414-1234, or if it's long distance, 800-926-8809 here on Perspectives as we continue our chat with Dr. Brad Schmidt and Dr. Dina Rollinger, both from Florida State University. Let's see if we can get up with Lou, who's given us a call here on line one to add to the conversation. Hey, Lou, welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to comment that I know of at least one place in town where Democrats and Republicans and independents all still work together. I'm a proud member of the Zonta Club of Tallahassee, and it's a professional businesswomen's service organization. And I'm one of two Republicans in about a club of about 45 or 50 members. And I'm a past president, and I've been a member for 13, 14 years now. And we work on all kinds of advocacy issues on behalf of women and girls, and we work on service projects for the, you know, charities around town to better our community, and it can be done. There is civil discourse out there. Even when you disagree with people, you have to respect that, you know, somebody else has a different point of view, and quite frankly, it makes you a better person to know what it is and understand other people's opinions. So it's out there. You just have to look for people that want to work together and want to get along.
Well, is that the secret then, Lou, that you folks put aside the other considerations and let's focus on those areas of common ground that we can work together on?
Well, that's primarily what we do, but quite frankly, we don't put it aside. We're all very frank about, you know, our ideas and our leanings. We're a bunch of intelligent women, and we know we have opinions about things, but it's just we don't take our differences as a personal attack on each other, and we try and encourage each other in whatever we believe in and want to work on behalf of, and we try and celebrate. I made several phone calls to friends of mine to congratulate them the the morning after President Obama was elected, even though I had worked on behalf of the other candidates.
Wow, that is terrific. So if anyone wants to get a good example of how people can reach accommodation despite differing political views, just check out the Zonda Club, right?
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Lou. Appreciate that. What do you think, Dina?
Well, Lou, thanks for the call, because it's a really important reminder. We do not see this on the nightly news or daily news or on Twitter, but these spaces exist. People get along all the time, and they can talk politics in respectful ways. So these spaces exist, but you have to be intentional about it. So there might have been rules that Lou didn't mention. So we agree, but we can agree or disagree, but when we disagree, we do it respectfully. And so so that this doesn't divide us. And that's so critically important. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, really, I really appreciate it. And that's an adaptive thing too, isn't it, Brad, that people over the millennia, despite the fear of the other, here comes another tribe, maybe they're going to steal our food and our women or whatever else, that still, as a species, we learned how to cooperate and accommodate differing views and ideas, right?
Right. So, you know, what I associate to, or what sort of struck me about Lou's story, is that what she said was, we don't take these as personal attacks, if we think about it, like threats, right? So it all has to do with perception. Stress is something that we all deal with in our lives, and stress can be negative or positive. What's interesting, though, is that what studies suggest is that it's how you perceive stress that makes a difference. In fact, getting back to some of the stuff we talked about a little earlier, there have been studies of perception of stress and how that affects medical outcomes. And if you follow two groups that have the same levels of stress, but one perceives it to be negative and the other perceives it to be benign or positive, guess what happens? Those that perceive it to be negative die at higher rates, just based on the perception, not on the stress level, right? And so I think that's sort of, again, sort of strikes me about what Lou's saying, is that you can be in a situation that's contentious, but how you're perceiving things and how you're managing things makes a big difference.
And the old phrase, it's worrying me to death, may not be just a phrase.
Depending on how you're perceiving things, it's not just a phrase, yes.
Let's go back to the phones. Donna gives us a call online too. Hi, Donna. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, such a pleasure to talk to your panel. I specialize in treating anxiety disorders, and I agree with your Dr. Schmidt there that nothing's more powerful than a thought, and our thoughts are immediately hijacked by, you know, a brain that's stressed out. And so my starting point with patients is to teach them how to self-regulate that fear response. And for the political discussion, it's interesting to view a lot of the media coverage and through that lens, that it's designed very carefully, very craftily to gin up fear, which then cuts off your ability to reason. And then it makes you very afraid. The other people are going to take your jobs, your house, your whatever, your freedom. And then, but that's okay. Come join our club, and now you can calm down because we'll take care of you. And you'll be all okay. Just join our club because those are the bad people, and we're the good people. And then the cycle starts over again with be afraid, be afraid, be very afraid. But that's okay. Come join our club. Those are the other bad people, and we're the good people. And the cycle goes on and on and on. So one of the things I do recommend to people who start getting into that fight and flight response over politics is you need to take a vacation from the news, and that does wonders. They can start sleeping again, and they sort of turn back into normal people.
You're saying that the condition is reversible. Boy, there is hope, Donna. Thank you. I feel much better already. But Dr. Dean, you've seen that being used, of course, the manipulation of coverage in the media to keep that arousal level high so that people will, again, go through the next commercial break and, you know, you'll maintain your ratings and all that kind of thing.
Right. And I think that Donna's strategies are great ones. I think one of the things I have my students do all the time is I just have them keep track of what they're doing with mass media. So how often are you actually on your phone engaged on social platforms, media platforms? What are you doing? And then ask them why. So is it something that they're avoiding? Do they feel like they have to constantly see if someone likes something that they've posted? So I think that if we can get people to reflect, first to acknowledge how much they're using media, which is usually 2 to 3 times more than they think, but then get them to think about why they're engaging, and then compartmentalizing it, saying, okay, I check my email 3 times a day instead of I'm constantly checking my email. I'm constantly looking to see what's on Google News. What happened? Who said what? What's Donald Trump put on Twitter today? So it can be very compelling. It's designed to be compelling and to draw us in. So we have to find, like Donna said, strategies to get back off a little bit.
Yeah, but as Dr. Brad said, that isn't easy to do. It is a great coping mechanism and, in fact, may be absolutely essential for our continued sanity and physical health. But we're now conditioned to do this, and sometimes our jobs even require it. If you do not respond to your boss's 10 p.m. email, you're in deep stuff.
Yeah. Let me just amplify one point that Donna made, though, Tom, and I think this is an important piece to insert into the discussion. And anxiety, we've been talking about how prevalent it is, how bad it is, how it's a chronic condition, how it's worsening. But on the flip side, there is good news, and that is we actually have very effective treatments for anxiety, and we haven't brought that up yet. So, just to sort of amplify a little bit what Donna mentioned.
Well, let's think about the treatments here on the other side of the break. It's rapidly bearing down on us. I want to give full opportunity to respond on that there is hope. We want this to be a positive, uplifting discussion today on Perspectives, and we'll be right back. We also want to include your calls, 414-1234, and we'll be Are you feeling anxious, out of sorts? The heartbreak of psoriasis got you down? Well, you've come to the right place because this is Perspectives on WFSU, and we are talking about lowering the anxiety level in this hyper-partisan political era that we're going through. And Dr. Brad Schmidt has some great ideas on how to kind of ramp down that level of angst. What do you think?
Well, just before the break, I did want to insert some of the good news into sort of the dismal side of the discussion, and that is, I think it is important for people to know that there certainly are very quick and easy strategies for dealing with stress, like we talked about. Let's just turn off the news and not listen to it, right? But if folks are experiencing clinically significant anxiety, it's important to know that there are really effective treatments for those that are suffering from it. Anxiety conditions do tend to be chronic, but that's because the vast majority of folks don't get effective treatments, unfortunately. So it's really unfortunate, but we do have very good treatments, both skill-based treatments to change sort of thinking and behaviors, and psychopharmacology. There are good medications that oftentimes will help people who are suffering from these things. But I did want to just make sure we inserted some of the good news into what we've been talking about.
Okay. And Jeff on line one wanted to add to that discussion as well when it comes to anxiety treatments. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I wanted to ask your panel what they knew about flotation therapy and how that could help reduce levels of anxiety and stuff. I'm actually in the process of opening a float center here in town.
Oh, wow. Okay. Any information on that? I think part of it is, as I recall, tied to sensory deprivation and that, where you're sort of breaking the bounds of gravity and you're just in a much less threatening environment than even sitting in a chair.
Yeah, it's not anything that I'm very familiar with, but I could see how some people would enjoy floating around. For other folks that have a lot of anxiety, that would probably freak them out.
Yeah, if you got fear of water, it probably is not a good indicator there. Let's see. Young's been hanging on line three. Let's go there. Hi, Young. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi. So I just had an interesting comment that I wanted some thoughts on. I'm a college student or college aged, and a lot of my peers are, they've kind of been so thrown off by this hyper-partisanship that if they hear any sort of opinion from someone who identifies as a Democrat or Republican, they'll kind of dismiss the entire idea, the entire argument, based on, like, the fact that they are representing a party or something along those lines. And I wonder how you guys thought about that as a sort of, like, weird coping mechanism for the sort of stress of this atmosphere.
Oh, wow. Let's start with you, Dr. Dina. What do you think where it becomes a form of aversion rather than to try to get your point across by getting people more aroused, you're actually driving them away.
Well, I'll be curious to see what Brad says about that. But I can say that college age opting out is been – there's a long tradition of opting out and when you're in the college age. So some people will get hyper-engaged, but others will just simply – step back and say, politics right now is not for me. And so I think this ties back to what Brad was saying before about there can be really different responses in how people manage these different kinds of anxieties, whether it's political or physical. And so it's not surprising at all that Young has some friends that just are done for now. But perhaps in the future, they'll reengage.
Okay. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, so I guess what I would associate to here is that if we think about, again, what anxiety was designed for us to do, and that is the reason we have all this arousal is to prepare us to act. And the overwhelming action tendency when we're anxious is to avoid. So if you're dealing with people you don't want to hear or you don't like what they're saying, you could shut down and avoid. And so that's, I think, a normal reaction to having a lot of stress and anxiety. Some people will choose that course to avoid.
Oh, so that's not the fight response, it's the flight response,
sure.
Essentially.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Well, and Dr. Dina, you were saying of just disconnecting completely. I'm sure that has no precedent, and I'm thinking of a phrase that was turn on, tune in, drop out. That rings some bells in the deep, dark recesses. So this might be pretty typical, huh?
Right. Again, it's at college age, some folks really will get – I know for myself – that was when I discovered politics. I didn't know anything. I grew up in a very apolitical family. And for me, it was this eye-opening experience. And I tried to get involved in all kinds of things. But for others, it just seemed like an inconvenience and not something that they wanted to do. Or they didn't like who was running and didn't want to get involved in a presidential election. People have very different responses.
So. Sure. Both sides are wrong. It's all corrupt. Okay. I see. How about Jim on line four to add him to the discussion? Hi, Jim. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've been listening with interest. I'm not sure I have solutions for our anxieties, but I do think I'm having a little bit of a hard time because I'm semi-retired from doing a daily talk show that involved politics in New Mexico. And so I'm still looking for information all the time and forming opinions, even though that's not my work anymore. But I did want to, Tom, I believe, was talking about the intimate relationship with the bandmate, and then they change, and it reminded me of something that happened in Taos. Before the 2012 elections, I was really, talking about those elections, and I was trying to get people to call in. Well, most of northern New Mexico is on the Democratic side, so I never got a call from a conservative. So I would call my brother in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who's very conservative, and he would argue with me on the radio. But I ended up having to hang up on him three times over a 2-year period because he wouldn't stop talking.
So a recovering talk show host. Oh, my gosh, Jim, that's great.
Yeah, and I have sad news for you. It's not very good out here because you can't give it up. That's the problem.
Yeah, it can have its own form of addictive qualities. Boy, thanks for the input on that. But there are, just as we said at the outset of the show, and if you're joining us here, we are talking about the state of anxiety that the current political situation has engendered among so many folks and how it's alienated families and destroyed marriages, Dr. Dina, as you were saying, and Dr. Brad, how you were also saying that it's causing some folks maybe to revert into survival mode, because that is one of the more elemental reactions we have to stress, the fight or flight response. And if you can't flee, you're going to fight. And maybe that's why so many folks are so angry right now. Although, really, empirically, do we have truly, in when it comes to the solid physical threats to our well-being, aren't we kind of in better shape now than maybe we have been in the past?
There's no doubt that we're, you know, living in an age where things are much better than they have in terms of people dying from diseases and wars and all kinds of things like that. So objectively, that's absolutely correct. If you think about 9/11 and the sort of terrorist threats that were so pervasive and continue to be pervasive, the likelihood that someone is going to be killed by a terrorist is so low relative to the perception that there's this threat out there. So in part, what's happened is, I think the media has contributed to this, is that people have this sense that these threats are somehow increased or greater, but objectively, that's just not the case.
Yeah, and we have seen that even when it comes to such things as, say, mass shootings. And Dr. Dini, I'm thinking of, we had the movie Newtown, which was shown at the Challenger Learning Center last night, which was how the community of Newtown in Connecticut recovered from the 2012 school shootings and came back together, which was a real healing process for them. But as much media coverage as those kinds of incidents or the nightclub in Orlando or all that happened, statistically, the number of deaths by firearms in the United States is on a decrease.
Right. War on drugs was another one that got a lot of attention. Halloween candy, that's one that we just probably heard recently.
Or Halloween clowns.
Right. Halloween clowns. So how we should be scared of these. The likelihood that we're going to die in an airplane is very, very low, right? But these are the stories. These are the fears that are crafted. But one of the things I loved that Jim pointed out is that we don't do a good enough job exposing ourselves to opposing points of view. So I loved that he had, you know, a relative come on and fight with him so that he had a conservative point of view. And this is one of the things that I think helps increase our anxiety and the sense of fear, because you might go from watching a cable news station that has a particular slant, then go online and see what, you know, a website, what their slant is. And so they've done research, and you can see that you're getting a lot of the same fear messaging on these different kinds of outlets, which would just make them, amplify them, make them louder in your brain, which could be very bad for you, especially if you never go and look to see what the other side is actually saying.
Because so many of our arguments right now are based on what has been called fact-free reporting.
Yeah, absolutely.
That if we say something on an NPR station, it's immediately countered on a commercial station, say, that has a more left or right-wing bent. And, of course, we are suspect because we are in the bag for Hillary. They are suspect. They're in the bag for whatever. And you have this divide that you cannot bridge.
Right. Unless individuals make a conscious effort to go expose themselves to information to which they feel uncomfortable. And that's really an important step.
Okay. Let's go to Gary on line two and see what's on his mind. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Perspectives. Hello, Gary.
Yes, is this radio station?
Yes, it is. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, well, I'm a clinical hypnotherapist, and I want you to know when I have people, the biggest problem people have is anxiety and stress, you know. The AMA says 80%. They say it's 8% of people's six. You know how it works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
No, I was not aware of the number. No, sir.
The American medical thing says 80% has anxiety and stress. It causes all the problems, they say. And it's about that consistent stress.
Well, as Dr. Brad, you were talking about if regardless of the pervasiveness of the stress, it's going to be there in one way, shape, or fashion. It then depends on the reaction of the person to the stressors that really makes the difference.
Yeah. So one thing that Gary's pointed out, which is absolutely true, and that is with these large-scale studies, they find that anxiety disorders are the most prevalent or one of the most prevalent mental health conditions. So it's an extremely common form of mental illness, and many, many millions of people are affected by it. And the level of disability and impairment that's created by these conditions is obviously quite high, where they estimate each year maybe close to $1 billion is lost in terms of lost days at work or increased healthcare utilization and things like that. So it's a very high level of public health burden that's accounted for by these conditions.
There's even a contemporary song out right now, and I'm thinking of the lyrics of it. I wish we could turn back time to the good old days when the mama sang us to sleep, but now we're stressed out. In other words, we no longer... Once we have left the comfort and security of childhood and we are assailed by all of the different challenges of being a grown-up and having to make decisions, and whether it's financial challenges or anything else, we can't function. That's scary. We can't grow up.
Well, I don't know if we can't grow up. I think one of the things that's so interesting about our conversation about fear and being overwhelmed all the time is what individuals want to do. So when we're so overwhelmed by not only national problems but international problems, what we tend to do is tune it out and focus on the things that we have more control over, which is our family. So in some ways, it's not a refusal to grow up, perhaps, but focusing on the things where we think we can make a difference.
Well, Jim's back with us here, and I think you have another suggestion here on how you can deal with this type of thing, right, Jim?
Yes. I found that if I try and dial down my interest in world affairs and national politics and focus instead on local groups like Sustainable Tallahassee, Transition Tallahassee, the Tallahassee Time Bank, these are groups that are working on problems that we can all, you know, solve and make our community better. And oftentimes, you know, partisans can agree on those issues and work, you know, to improve the local scene.
That is a wonderful idea. And that seemed to be maybe a little more common in the days when we had more small towns in the country. Everybody knew each other. They were more cohesive, perhaps. But everyone joined an Elks or a Rotary, or like Lou said, a Zonta Club earlier in our discussion here. And if you can't do anything about the makeup of Congress beyond just voting for your particular member of Congress, maybe you can get involved in, I don't know, doing decorative planting in the city square or something like that. And does that help, Brad?
Well, yeah, and I think to take a step back, the reason why these things are useful, and this is something that Dina alluded to earlier, is that we know that two parameters that are very relevant to anxiety are predictability and controllability. If you feel like you can predict things, if you feel like you can control things, then that's going to dampen your anxiety. So if we think about dealing with international or national level issues versus in my neighborhood, this is what I can do. I can join this club and we'll do this and that. You can have an effect. You feel like you can predict and control this, and that might contribute. Your ability to control the election or national and international events is minimal, right?
Yeah, and some folks have suggested, and certainly on this program a lot, that who you elect to, say, the Tallahassee City or the Leon County Commission has more direct impact on your life than mm-hmm. who you elect as president of the United States.
Right, and I think it's really important for people to remember there's all this conversation about, well, we should opt out or we're going to opt out. And what research shows is that even if we don't love our candidates, we're more satisfied when we participate. So that in and of itself is a reason to go out on Tuesday and vote.
Okay. And if you are a Democrat, find a Republican down the street and go out and plant a tree or something.
There you go.
Or vice versa. But and at least you have something tangible. You can say, look what we did together.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be just a political group. Social groups can do the same. Religious groups. There's all kinds of groups that you can get involved in and feel really good about the work you're doing.
A gentleman I know who helped a lot of addicts on the road to recovery, whether it was alcohol or opioids or anything else, said that the main thing you need to do is to get outside of yourself and find common ground with someone else. And that's a good first step to recovery for a multitude of ills. Dr. Brad Schmidt and Dr. Dina Rollinger, both from Florida State University. Thank you so much for coming on Perspectives and enlightening us on how we can get our anxiety levels down and forget about the stupid election next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, guys. Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls doing the technical stuff today. And I'm Tom Flanagan. At this time next week, the election will be over, we hope, and we'll sit down with a retiring state attorney for the 2nd Judicial Circuit, Willie Meggs. We'll catch you then next week right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.